Great. Good evening, everyone. Thank you to our anonymous sponsor. Thank you to the Americuses for hosting tonight. What I want to do tonight is the following. I'm going to go over just a couple points that we had discussed in past Shiurim very quickly. Both one or two points that I had mentioned before that there were issues I wanted to look into a little bit. So I'll just very quickly give you those points and a few other points that I had heard some recordings along the way from various Rabbanim that have had some ha'aros on the points that we mentioned. So I'll just mention them as well. And then after that, we'll move into the discussion of Maser Ksufin beginning tonight. And that will carry over, God willing, until next week's Shir, which will be part two. Okay. First, just to, again, I apologize to those of you who were not here in the last week or two, but just take about 10, 15 minutes here to just go through a couple of points. Okay, point number one. So somebody had asked me last week, and again, by the way, let me just interrupt here for one more time. If you don't mind, any questions on these back points, unless they're very quick questions, we'll have to wait till afterwards just to make sure we have enough time. If it's a quick question, you know, we can give you a quick answer, but if it's more complicated, then it'll have to wait. But again, just very quickly, one question that was asked was about, we had discussed who you should give your money to, who you should give your tzedakah to, and we mentioned that it was possible that giving tzedakah to your parents is something that definitely should be done if it needs to be done. Ideally, we said it's better not to give from tzedakah money if you can help it, but if you don't have enough and your parents need, then absolutely you can give from tzedakah or maaser money for your parents. And we had discussed that in general for other types of aniyim other than your parents, it's better not to give to one person your entire sum of money for tzedakah. It's rather better to spread it out a little bit between different people. We had mentioned that the post can say that for your parents it's okay to give the whole thing, and you should give the whole thing to your parents if they need it. So the question was basically, what about in-laws? So we didn't have time to discuss it last week. The in-laws are outlaws, right? in this case, I think it's in-laws. and you're if you, God forbid, if you and your wife are divorced and your divorced wife needs tzedakah, I think we mentioned this, and if we didn't, then that also is in the same category, that you do have a mitzvah to give tzedakah to them as well. The in-laws and also divorced wife, those are basically counted immediately after the other relatives we mentioned last week in terms of the Seder of Kedima, of the priorities. The in-laws come immediately after all the rest of your relatives. So the question was whether you can give all of your money, your tzedakah money, to your in-laws the same way that you can give all of your tzedakah money to your parents. So the answer seems to be no, meaning as follows, meaning that you, in general, it's recommended, again, it's not obligatory to do this, but the post can recommend that you're not supposed to give all of your tzedakah money to one person. It seems to be that only your parents is the exception to that rule, and that in-laws, at least for the husband, would not fall under that category, meaning that it's recommended that you should not give your in-laws all of your money. However, the way I was thinking about this a little bit, and I, you know, thought that there definitely might be some ways out. Again, the first way out is that it's not a prohibition. There's no iser here. So if you choose that this is what you want to do, then absolutely you have that right, even if we would say that it's not recommended. That's number one. Number two, some of the posts can bring down, I forgot where I saw this, but I think Rabbi Taub mentions this point in his book. He mentions that if you have relatives that are extremely in distress, meaning it's not just they need a little bit of money, but they really need money. They're really in trouble. So I believe he quotes a number of poskim here who want to say that maybe you can give all of your relatives all of your tzedakah money in that situation if basically they're stuck. So to find exactly where it is, but that was basically the general point in that case also, that maybe if it's something which is a little more in need than other people, then maybe it's okay. Yeah, he quotes here the Derech Hamuna, which is Rav Chaim Kanievsky's Sefer on Seder's Rhyme. So he has he basically quotes this, he's the one who quotes this from the Chazon Ish, that it's permitted to use all of your maaser money to help him if necessary, so that also might be something to use in this case. And number three, the other interesting thing, which again we did not have time to discuss last week, and we're not going to get into in detail now, but to the question of the relationship between husband and wife when it comes to tzedakah. So we've been talking from the perspective of the husband, because this is a men's shir, right? Sorry. I didn't say that. I know you are, that's why I have to be careful with this. So we had discussed it from the perspective of the husband, especially because generally speaking, it's assumed that halachically that the husband generally speaking owns the money in the marriage, regardless of how the money is spent and regardless of who's allowed to spend the money. However, there are many posts that say for tzedakah as well, that the wife, if she, generally speaking, has some sort of rights to spending, which I assume is true in most of our cases, that the wife definitely is the one who decides where to spend the money and how to spend the money, and the husband can't say anything about it. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. right? Okay. Got to play to two audiences here, you know? So anyway, if that's the case, which is totally fine, then the halacha seems to be, according to many poskim, that there's not a problem for the wife to give the tzedakah that she chooses to give as well. In this case, what you could say, again, if you take some little halakhic creativity here, again, this is my idea, I didn't see this anywhere, but if you take that idea a little bit farther, you can say that the husband is mochel to his wife, that she can give the tzedakah to the relatives that she desires. So if she wants to give the tzedakah to her parents, then she can give all the tzedakah she wants to her parents based on what we said previously. So if the husband is mochel on that, that might be another direction to go to say that there is no problem in that situation with giving to your in-laws, because your wife's parents deserve all of her tzedakah if she would be able to give it. Okay, again, just a couple bullet points there. Any other questions on that? We'll have to wait till later. Okay, a couple other points that we mentioned last time, which I wanted to supplement. We mentioned last time about giving every person, that there was a question whether you really have to give every single person in the street, and we had different discussions, different opinions about that. I just wanted to add that I heard, I finally got to listen to a share from Rabbi Willig on Why You Torah. I've been waiting for a while to listen to it, but it's, unfortunately, it's, you have to sit there and listen to it for a whole hour, and you don't always have a whole hour, whatever it is. I haven't actually bought an iPod yet, so I can't listen to it on the bus. If anybody wants to donate an iPod next time instead of the shear, that's more donations are more than welcome. That goes for the expenses of the shear itself, so that I can listen to all the shiurim that I need to beforehand. Anyway, so Willig basically also said the following, and I think I heard this from Rav Schechter also. Rav Schechter also had a shir on why you Torah on the halachos of tzedakah. I think he said the same thing. Basically, they both quoted, Rav Willig quoted Rav Yashav as saying he heard Rav Yashav holding that you do not have to give every single poor person that comes your way. His context was in Yerushalayim or other places in Eretz Yisrael where people are coming all the time just to stop you on the street in davening, you know, give me money. So he also quoted Rav Yashav as saying that you don't have to give to every single person that comes, despite some of the issues we've raised in the past. And it wasn't clear exactly what the reason why was. So Rabbi Willig mentioned two possible reasons why. One was from Rav Avram Shapira Zatzal, with the former Rashiv of Merkaz Arav. This Rav Schechter quoted as well. That basically people, if you're talking about real poor people, real aniyim that are coming to you, or maybe they're not real aniyim, but people that claim to be aniyim, not people that are coming to collect for organizations, but regular aniyim that are coming around. So we said last time that there's reason to believe that if a person, you know, is being lazy and doesn't really need the money because he could work, but instead he chooses to ask for tzedakah, then you don't necessarily have to give them. So Rav Avraham Shapira basically said that this person already has a business. He's got a business of collecting tzedakah. Every day he's out there on the street or in the shuls collecting money. So if that's the kind of person that we're talking about, then there's room to say that you do not have to, you don't have to give them. There were other sources as well to support that idea, but again, that was just the basic idea, which we already alluded to last week. We already suggested that point, but I just wanted to mention that I heard it now from other Rabbanim as well. Rabbi Willig also mentioned that he felt that letters that are mailed to you asking for money are also less, not so compelling, that you have to give every single one, which we also had mentioned was a machlokas, but that was Rabbi Willig went on record on in his shir, basically saying that he didn't feel that was something you had to do. And he said even more so, be careful about phone donations. He said when they ask you for tzedakah on the phone, be very careful what you say. It's better not to say anything at all, because sometimes you might say that I'm going to give, and then in the end you end up not giving, you forget, something else happens, and then in addition to not, you know, to them being upset at you, but you might violate a problem of nidrei tzedakah. This we have not had a chance to talk about, and I think we'll save this for a different round, but the halachas of nidrei tzedakah, if you take a neder, or not even a neder, if you just make a pledge, if you say, I'm going to give a certain amount of money to tzedakah, that may have the actual status of a neder, which means that it's a very serious thing if you do not come through on that pledge. That is therefore something which Willig suggested to be very careful about on the phone. If you say, yeah, I'll give this, I'll give that, but then in the end, you don't always come through with it. So Willig always says, okay, send me it in the mail. And then, of course, you know, when they send him in the mail, so, you know, he might not actually give it. But the point is that you don't get stuck with your nidrei tzedakah in that type of context. That also has to be careful, something to be careful about in shul. If you have in your mind that somebody's coming around to collect for tzedakah and you say, I'm going to give tzedakah, and then in the end he goes the other direction and you don't give it, that also might be a question. It's not clear, but it's a question. In that case, maybe you also have violated the mitzvah of nidrei tzedakah. Once you had in your mind, even if you did not verbalize it, if you had in your mind that that you were going to give it, in the end you decided not to, you may have to set aside that amount of money that you were going to give for tzedakah to give to somebody else. Okay. That'll take if anybody has a question on that, because we didn't mention that previously. Any quick questions on that point?
I heard that the things that they send you in the mail, like, for example, a safer or something like that, you're not obligated to actually make a donation.
Good. So Rabbi Willig actually dealt with that case also. This was my wife and I were in our office last night listening to the Shira and preparing each of us, preparing our individual things. So I was too engrossed in trying to make the source sheet. So when Rabbi Willig spoke about it, I actually missed what he said. So I asked my wife, what did he say there? Did he say it was okay? So she told me he said basically that you're not obligated to return anything for that because they give you the gift. They give you the book in the hope that you will give them something afterwards, but they're not demanding that if you don't give them money, you have to give back the safer. This is especially true, of course, for the breast lovers that come around and give their little pamphlets, if you know what I'm talking about. So they want you to be smisameach, they want you to take the pamphlet. They also want you to give some tzedakah. So Rabbi Willig said it's a good idea that if you're not going to give them any money, to try to give it back. But it's not an absolute obligation. It's something that they give you in hope for something, but it's not a chiyuv. It's something worthwhile to return if you're not going to actually give them anything. Sometimes they won't let you give it back. You have to see. You know? So breast lovers are very very intense when it comes to this. They might be more. Maybe they're a little shame shemayim. They actually want you to. They want you to get a little simcha in your life, even if you won't give them the money. They're still could be. They're still very happy about that. Okay, could be. Oh my goodness, sushi. Okay. All right. So next point. We mentioned last time the discussion about Hachnasas Kala. About the people that come around asking for Achnasas Kala, and really what they want is money to buy an apartment. So Rabbi Willig mentioned this point as well in passing. And basically what he said is that he felt that there is room to say that you should help them out. It's a very important thing to help them out if they won't be able to get married. Otherwise, absolutely, you should feel free. You should be. It's worthwhile to give them something. But he said there's no problem in asking them where exactly they want to buy the apartment. He said, okay, where do you want to buy the apartment? So if they tell you Arze Habira or they tell you Rechavia or a place which has exorbitantly expensive prices on the apartments, you can say, well, I'm not quite interested in paying money for a really expensive place. Maybe you should, you know, buy an apartment in a cheaper place like what used to be Beitar, and now I don't know where else is cheap. Haredi places that are cheap. What? No place is cheap now. All right, so you have this question. But again, it's something to what do you say?
Ramallah,
yeah. I heard the Haredim were taking over Ramallah, right? That's the next step, right? After Kiryat Sefer. That's the next one over.
Just
in Turei Karta. Okay. They're going to sit with the Palestinians in Ramallah. They don't have to take it over. Okay. Anyway, so you mentioned that he felt that that was something which is worthwhile to contribute to, but again, it's in your rights to ask them exactly where they're buying the apartment. You don't have to contribute necessarily if they're buying the most expensive place. Say again? He didn't address that part of the question. That was my ha'ara from last time. Again, he wasn't saying you have to. He was saying that it's a worthwhile cause. Okay. Very good. Another point, which I think we mentioned, but if we didn't, so the question of accepting government funding for tzedakah, for yeshivas. So the halacha that Rabbi Willig pointed out is that he felt that it has to be legal. This could be mostly, I think, in chutz la'aretz, in America, where you accept funding from the government. Here, too, it's an issue, but maybe less so here. But his main point was that it has to be legal. If the money you're getting from the government is not legal, then basically he said you should leave the kollel and close down the yeshiva. And if people come to you and say, well, we can't, you know, how can we not accept the money from the government? We'll have to close down. I'll have to leave the kollel if I can't accept the money that's the government is paying me, even though I don't, you know, maybe legally I don't deserve it for whatever reasons. He says, okay, close down the kollel, leave the kollel, close down the yeshiva, that's what you have to do. And he quoted Rav Soloveitchik, who also apparently said that at one point, that that's what has to happen. Absolutely, you cannot take money, which is illegal in any of these situations for yeshivas from the government, and if it means you have to close it down, then that's what you have to do. Okay, again, just another ha'ara there to mention. Two or three more ha'aras, then we'll move on.
If you don't know the money is illegal, but it's coming from somebody who has questionable, someone under investigation from the...
That's a great question. I think we're going to have to leave that question for now. I think every question in that regard perhaps requires individual investigation. I would say that if you can investigate it, you absolutely should. If you're not sure, there might be also questions of Chilul Hashem, and it might be better to avoid that money if you're not sure where it's coming from and you cannot verify it. That's the story with government funding. Another point that we mentioned last time that somebody asked about, which is the question of Anei Ircha Kodin. that the people in your city take precedence over people from another city. The Shaila was, well, what's considered to be your city if you live in Brooklyn? So is the Bronx, is Queens, is all of New York City considered to be your city? If you live in Yerushalayim, if you're in Givat Shaul, does that mean that the people in Talpiot or wherever else they might be coming, is that also considered to be Ani Ir HaKodin? So I had suggested last time that I didn't think it was based on the entire city. I thought it was based on the immediate area that you have Shaychas to, that you associate with. That was my feeling. And Rabbi Willig and Rav Schechter both confirmed that in their individual shiur. They both agreed essentially with that point. Rav Schechter added that you also can give to places or people or institutions or shuls or yeshivas that you identify with. Places where your children learn, shuls that you daven in, any place that you have some sort of identification with, even if it's not next door to you, also could be included in this category of Aniyei Ircha. Okay. Another point Rabbi Willig mentioned, which is not so relevant for us, but for those of you from America or other places where you might have been getting used to giving to the UJA or UJC in terms of giving your tzedakah money, so Rabbi Willig just happened to mention that that the past couple years there have been some issues with them becoming more anti-religious, not just parav, but actually anti-religious in terms of some of their activities. So he felt, he wasn't saying it was usher, but he felt that he had more problems giving to UJA for tzedakah, UJC for tzedakah money than he used to. Again, that issue we're not going to go into in detail now. I just wanted to point that out. The last point, which is a very important point that we left last time, was the question of accepting money from goyim for certain activities. So we left with the question of what's the story with Nefesh B'Nefesh, who, at least at the beginning, still not sure exactly what's happening now, but at least at the beginning, and perhaps now as well, were accepting money from many Christians in other places in the world. The Shaila was, are you allowed to accept money from goyim? So we went through the whole discussion last time. We said that that the Gemara seems to say, according to many opinions, that you're not allowed to, but if you're stuck, then maybe you're allowed to in private, and if you can't, that doesn't help you, then maybe you can do it in public. The question we had was that we weren't sure whether that was only true in a case where it's for life, meaning you can't survive if you don't take their money, which was the language of Efshar Lachayosa, you can't live. Or the question was, maybe it meant any case where if you don't have their money, you won't get any money instead. There won't be any replacement money, then maybe you can take their money. So sorry, question?
Is this only the case where you need the money, or what if they just give it to you as a present?
Good. Oh, so give me a minute, and we'll get to that. So I emailed very fast from Nefesh B'Nefesh. I think it was that night that I emailed him. And Baruch Hashem, the next day in the morning, I found a response on my email. He gave me, in about 3 seconds, running in between meetings, he gave me a whole list of ideas, which I'll just mention very briefly. We're not going to go into all of them, but just some of the Bekitzer Nimrats. Some of the points that he mentioned were as follows. He said that the reasons to be Megil in their case were the following. Number one, he felt that a number of the poskim, and this still has to be investigated a little bit, but he felt that a number of the poskim believed that in the case where they offer you the money, exactly as you're saying, when they offer you the money, and you don't solicit the money from them, then there's more room to accept it. And that seems to be, if you look at the Aruch HaShulchan, I think it's in Siman Reish and Aleph, so the Aruch HaShulchan does seem to go in that direction, that if they offer the money on their own, then you may be able to accept it. If you look at the language in the Shulchan Aruch, it's not so simple, because the Shulchan Aruch, I think it was on the source sheet from last week, seemed to say that you cannot ein litol tzedakah min hanachem, that you can't take tzedakah from them. From the Shulchan Aruch, I definitely could read the Shulchan Aruch easily as saying that not only can you not ask them for money, but you cannot receive money from them. So that's a question, but there definitely are shitas that would seem to say that it's that if they give it to you on their own, then it might be permitted. Another direction that he wanted to suggest, which again I was not able to verify inside from the Makor that he was trying to quote, but again he did say that a number of the poskim suggested this point, that if you're not talking about actual aniyim, we're talking about projects, meaning here, we're not talking about people that are necessarily poor, there are people that choose to make aliyah, and once they're choosing to make aliyah, we are making a project to fund them, so he felt also that that type of project, which is not exactly the same thing as an ani, might be better in terms of the question of accepting tzedakah from the non-Jews, again for the same reason we discussed last time a little bit about Chil Hashem, we don't support our own, you know, we don't support our own aniyim, so perhaps, you know, he was saying that that concern of Chil Hashem is not as great when it comes to projects than when it comes to actual poor people. Again, one can take issue with this, but that's there was another direction.
If you call it a project, then can anybody else then give tzedakah to it and then maybe be called tzedakah?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Theoretically, if you're supposed to be giving tzedakah to aniyim and Ravitas is, you know, calling Nefesh B'Nefesh.
I see what you're saying. You're asking for the Jewish perspective. If we're giving tzedakah. Good. Okay, good question. That we will hopefully speak about next week when we talk about the Maser Kesafim in terms of where the Maser Kesafim money is able to go. Okay. The answer is probably yes. The answer is probably yes. Generally speaking, today the minhag today, Rabbi Willie pointed this out as well, but we know the minhag is to give maaser money to a lot of different causes. Many worthwhile projects are usually included, and usually we assume that that's perfectly fine. So that would probably be okay. The other point that he mentioned also is that many of the poskim felt that when we say iyashar l'achayoso here, it's lav dafka. It doesn't mean that you can't survive without it. It means if you won't get the money from other places, this is the only source of the money that you'll get, then it's permitted to take it. And Rav Moshe actually has a tshuva, which again, I apologize, was not on my source sheet, but Rav Moshe has a tshuva about honoring a goy who is a donor at a banquet. And Rav Moshe says it's perfectly permitted to do that. And the way Rav Moshe basically says it, he says it's ideal not to be taking money from non-Jews if you can avoid it. But he says if you have no other source for the money that you're getting from them, then it's permitted. Which again, he doesn't say that if you can't live, if it's pikuach nefesh, etc. He says if you can't get the money that you're getting from them, if you can't get it from other sources, then you can accept it if you need to, even if Rav Moshe. He says that grudgingly, but he's willing to say that. So that also might be a support for saying that it's permitted in this case, even if we're not necessarily talking about pikuach nefesh, but any case where they wouldn't have been able to get that amount of money they raised from the Christians from Jewish sources at that time, then also would be okay. And he basically said that the three poskim that they spoke to, which all were okay with this for these reasons at least, were Rav Shechter from YU, Rav Simcha Cook from Rehovot, and Rav Lau, the previous chief rabbi. Their more central issue was something that we also had discussed last week, which was the question of the intentions of the Christians giving the money. Why are they giving the money? Are they giving money because of, we'll call the shma reasons, or are they giving the money because they want other things to be happening in the back of their minds? They're hoping, as we mentioned last time, that we'll all come to Israel, and that will cause, for their religion, that will cause Christianity to maybe fast forward a little bit in terms of what they think is the way that history should play itself out, if you know what I mean. And that was what he said they wanted to investigate a little bit more, and I think at the end they were satisfied that was not necessarily a problem. Okay, that's it for the questions from last time. Let's move into the questions of Maaser Ksavim. So this is the structure of how we're going to do this. We'll get however far we get tonight. First, we'll just start with a little bit of an introduction to what it's based on and some of the general ideas. Then we will move into the question of deductions from, which money that you receive is chayav and maaser. That's the next section. Which money that you get is money that you have to take maaser from. The third section will be the question of deductions from maaser. What money that you make can you deduct from your maaser calculations? And the last section will be the question of what can you what types of causes can you give your maaser money for? What's included in maaser money in terms of things that you spend money on, both in your regular expenses as well as in terms of other tzedakah causes, what's included? We will not get to all that tonight. We will start that tonight. We'll get to however far we get to tonight, and God willing, we will continue next week. Okay. So, being that this past week's parsha was Parshas Vayetze, so Yaakov Avinu says at the beginning of this past week's parsha, Parshas Vayetze, this is now in source number one, Yaakov is in the middle, right after the dream that he had with the Malachim. So he says that this matzeva, this stone here that I made as a matzeva, should be a beis elokim, a house of Hashem. And everything that you give me, Hashem, I will give you aser asrenu lach. I will surely give you a tenth of that. So if you look at source number two, so the Das Zakeim and Bali Atosos comment on this pasuk. They say, according to the Medrash, Yaakov tikein l'seis maser min ha'mon. Yaakov was actually the initiator of this concept of maser ksafim. Yaakov was the first one to do it, and that's what Yaakov is referring to here in this pasuk.
Wasn't Avraham and Malki said that? Wasn't that?
Say again.
Avraham and Malki said good.
That's great. Great point. So some of the other Mefarshim also point that out. It says that Avraham bayitzen lo maaser mikol, that Avraham gave Malki Tzedek, who was a kohen, maaser from everything that he had. But it's not clear from there that actually, what do they say? I think what they say, the answer would be the following. The answer would be that in that case, Avram chose to do it as his, he just did it. In this case, Yaakov makes a proclamation. He says, I will hereby do this. That's similar to what we discussed before as a neder tzedakah. That might be more of an idea of a formal takana, perhaps according to the opinion of the Das Zakenim. Yeah, guy.
Is this something that for himself personally or for his whole family?
Good. So it seems from here, the simple pshat of both the Pasuk and the Das Zakenim is that he took it on for himself. But the point is that this is the early precedent for the modern concept of Maaser Ksavim. That's the way the Das Zakenim sees it. Again, not everybody agrees with this, but it's relevant because it was this past week's parsha. It's worthwhile to point out that shita. David Orbach also showed me an interesting Zayim LaTorah. I don't think I remember the whole thing, but the part that I remember was also on this pasuk, that Yaakov here was making a very important point, that the first thing you need to do when you have this idea of giving tzedakah or maser is that you have to recognize what that means, is that you realize that your money you didn't make on your own. This is an important hashkafic point. Your money is not yours. Your money comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the fact that you're giving your money away signifies that that you realize that your money is not yours, and it's something that was given to you as a deposit, as a pikadon, as we mentioned in the very first year of tzedakah, and therefore you're willing to give it away. And then the fact that you actually give it away, again, means is a level, it demonstrates your level of commitment to your relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was, again, just one point from the Aznayim Latar, which is an important Tashkafic point to mention when it comes to Master Ksavim. Now, regardless of what the Dasa Kanan means here, that Yaakov instituted this idea of Master Ksavim, the question can still be asked, from a halachic perspective, what is the level of obligation of Master Ksavim? Where is it based on? So this, we had mentioned, we discussed this in last year's shir when we talked about this. We mentioned this briefly. We'll mention it again briefly. It's a machlokas haposkim, what the status is. Tosfos says in source number 4, actually source number 3, the Gemara says in Tanis, Aser ta Aser, the Torah says later on in Sefer Dvarim, you shall surely take Maaser, Aser bishvil shetit Asher, a play on words, you should take Maaser in order so that you should become rich. The word Osher means riches, so if you take Maaser, then you will become rich. That is the Gemara. And then Tosfos points out here, we're not going to read the whole thing inside, but basically Tosfos quotes the Sifrei, the Medrash on Sefer Dvarim, which basically says that this is true, the Medrash Darshan, this is true not only for things that are grown in the field, for produce maser, but also true for monetary maser. That's what he points out there in terms of pragmatia, business and other types of assets that you get. So they Darshan from this pasuk that that's also included in the idea of maser, and this opinion of Tosfos seems to be the opinion that holds that the chiyuv of maser ksafim is actually doraisa. That's Tosfos. Other shitas hold that Maser Ksafim might be only Dirabanan, meaning it's a chiyuv, but it's only Dirabanan. And the third shita, which is the most prevalent approach of the majority of poskim, is that Maser Ksafim is only a minhag. And if you look in source number 5, this is from the Aruch HaShulchan, so he quotes this as well. He says, Ulafi Masha Biranu, according to everything he has explained previously, which is not in the source here, Mukhra Kedas HaGdolim, it's clear, like the opinion of the Gdolim, HaSovrim, the Maser Ksafim, Eimlam Shum Ikar Min HaTorah. There is no basis for Maser Ksafim in the Torah. That's the opinion of the Bach in your Adea. And basically, what the way that the Acharonim understand this is that it's not really Ikar Min HaTorah, it's not Zerabanan either, but rather, it is only what we call a Minhag Tov. It's a very important minhag tov, but nevertheless, it is only has the status of a minhag. The Chavos Ya'ir passes this way, the Pischei Tshuva quotes this, the Chazam Sofer quotes this, the vast majority of Acharonim.
What do they do with the
pasuk
with Yaakov? They just consider it a remez in the Torah?
Yeah, Yaakov decided, I'm going to give Hashem everything that he got, but Yaakov does not make it obligatory on us to give Maaser. There are other psukim also that Yitz mentioned. There's a number of different sources, but again, they hold that all of these kinds of things are not making an obligation of Maaser Ksofim. Maaser Ksofim is a minhag. If that's the case, if we accept that Maser Ksafim is a minhag, the question is, what is the difference between Maser Ksafim and the regular chiyuv of tzedakah that we've been speaking about over the past couple of weeks? So essentially the answer is as follows, that tzedakah generally applies only when you have poor people in front of you. If you have a poor person that comes to you asking for money, assuming that he's legit, then the halacha is that you have a mitzvah to give him based on tzedakah. Maser Ksafim means whatever you earn, you set aside one-tenth of that money so that whenever Aniyim will come, then you will have something to give them. Or perhaps there are other organizations or other places out there that could use your money that you have to go searching for. They don't come to you, but you have to go to them. But that would be the idea of Maser Ksafim, that regardless of who comes to you, you still have this obligation, or this minug at least, of separating one-tenth of your assets for tzedakah. So being that it's a minhag, so it's a very important minhag. It's something which really everybody should accept, but if you have not accepted it, or if you didn't realize it was only a minhag, so then basically what you want to do is accept it as a bli neder. That's what the post can recommend. Don't say that I'm going to do this as a neder, or don't even use the word neder. Don't say at all, I'm going to accept it. What you should say is that bli neder, I'm going to accept upon myself the minhag tov of Maser Ksafim to the best of my ability, and therefore, in some situations, if you can't do it or you don't have enough money, etc., then it's very easy to get out of it without a problem once you already said bli neder. If you didn't realize in the past that it was only a minhag, you thought it was an obligation, so you can again say later that at this point, now that I realize that it's only a custom, I am accepting it upon myself as a bli neder, that I will do it as every time that I'm able to. Okay. One or two other points. You have a question?
I just wonder, when halacha talks about maser, does it mean...
When?
When halacha says the word maser,
right,
does it literally mean a tenth, or does it mean a qualified amount? We'll have to determine what that is later.
It means a tenth. It means a tenth.
Okay.
It definitely means a tenth. We have to discuss exactly how to calculate that tenth, but it definitely means a tenth. Okay. One or two other points to mention here. Rabbi Willig pointed this out, and the Avas Chesed, written by the Chavetz Chaim, mentions this. Rabbi Tab also points this out in his sefer. It's a good idea. It's a good idea, not obligatory, and there are other factors as well, but it's a good idea to make yourself a separate Maser account. What's the logic here? The logic is that if you make a separate account, that this is to be my Maser account, so anytime you earn your money, so all you have to do is just take the money and immediately dump it right into your Maser account. So that's why... So the Avos Chesed of the Chofetz Chaim writes this. There are other Achronim also that point this out, but Rabbi Taub, he collects it here from a few other sources.
You found that practical experience in America, but not practical in Israel.
Oh, so that was the other point I was going to make. Let's see what he quotes here. The Shalah points this out. There are a number of other Achronim that mention this. That's a good idea to make a separate Maser account, just so that you understand that when the money is there, so you can't touch it. It's not that every single person that comes to you and asking for money, oh, well, I have to give another one. That's something which is a worthwhile idea to consider. Now, happens to be that I had the same issue, that in Eretz Yisrael, it's a little bit more complicated, and you may actually have to spend money on creating an account here. It could be that that in Eretz Yisrael, it's not necessarily as easy to do as it is in America, and maybe there would be other methods of achieving the same goal. I did find in some of the Israeli Sfarim, they do mention the same point, that it's worthwhile to try to make some sort of separate place to put your maser money. They don't use the actual term bank account here. But again, I think I found in the other sefer called Tzedakah U'Mishpat, he mentions something along the same lines. You have to think about this, exactly how to do it, but some way of also sort of separating your maser money so that you know that it's already separate, so you don't feel bad later when you need to use it. You say, oh, I'm giving all this money. Again, it's not a chiyuv, and I have to admit it myself, I have not specifically been mocked that I'm trying to do it this way, but it's definitely something which is something worthwhile if it's possible. The other point that goes with that is really the question of how often do you have to separate your maser money. This also is a question. There are different opinions about this as well. The accepted opinion in terms of the base opinion or the base chiv seems to be that you should do it once a year. The Aruch HaShulchan points this out. If you look quickly, we're not going to read the whole thing now, but if you look at source number 10, so the Aruch HaShulchan in the first line of source number 10 says, V'cheinu davar pashut, it's something which is obvious, sheharebach, that all of your profits, mechashven b'chol shana v'shana, that you calculate every single year, the Rosh Hashanah ad Rosh Hashanah, from Rosh Hashanah until Rosh Hashanah, and if during this year you had some business dealings, some you made a profit on, some you lost, you can make a general cheshbon of the whole year, and that which you have a profit after calculating everything for the whole year, that which you afterwards say, this is my profit, then you can say, then you can give that amount of money to tzedakah. You don't have to go calculating it every single month, every single paycheck that you get. You don't have to give maser from every paycheck automatically as it comes in. If you want to do it, again, that's what we mentioned before, it's a great idea to do that and separate the money immediately. It's definitely a nice idea and hashkafically worthwhile, but the base idea, the base chiyuv seems to be, according to most of the posts, given that it's done from once a year, is perfectly fine. Some people
what
do it during...
Then,
yeah.
Then you're going to calculate, you know, I had a profit this year of, you know, X thousand of shekels, X thousand of dollars, and then you give that money in the following year?
Yeah, meaning you should give the money soon afterwards, but you separate the money at the end of the year. This is how much money I made this year from my salary, et cetera, et cetera. These are the things that I lost during my business expenses, and this is my, you know, my base, my net total, right? My net total, and from that money, that's how much you would give, you know, 10% of my salary.
So if your profit was 50,000 shekels for the year,
right.
I'm now going to have
right.
5,000 shekels, but I'm going to give that 5,000 shekels over the following year. Now,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's...
Meaning the
that's,
past year,
right.
Even though I made the profit in Tavshan Ayin, I'm not giving it
to... You should give it soon afterwards. You shouldn't wait around for another year to give it. But yeah, you can do that, and then...
It makes more sense to spend it out over the year, because for a whole year you won't have any other money coming in.
That's fine.
You'll wait
that's
another
fine.
Year to...
That's fine. What we're saying is that the minimum, the least amount, that what's perfectly acceptable to do is to do it once a year. I just mentioned Ray Willig. He suggested a different suggestion, that if you're going to do it once a year, do it during tax season, because, again... During tax season is the time that you're doing all these calculations anyway, so it's a good idea to at the same time calculate your maser money as well. Yeah.
Good. If you die during the year?
Good. Excellent. So that's a good point. the response would seem to be that we accept an idea of zrizu maktiv limitzvos. It's great if you can do it every time you get your paycheck, immediately take 10% and set it aside. That's wonderful. All we're saying here is that if you're like me and you don't always do that, or you don't get your paychecks on time, I won't say where that's happening, but what profession I'm in, but you all understand what we're talking about here. What'd you say? That's a separate issue, but that's not my problem. That's their problem. that we talked about last. We did discuss the question of Baltal. We had a share on that last year. We're not going to go into that again. But the base chiv is that you should do it once a year. Do more than that, great, but there's no obligation to do it every single time.
And if I'm somebody's inheritor, I'm getting, if I'm receiving the inheritance...
We'll get there. Okay, give me a few minutes. We'll get there. That's Rav Hashem. Okay?
I'm going to ask about their tzedakah, not mine.
Oh. What do you mean?
Do I have to worry?
No. You're good.
Maybe they didn't pay their maaser. That's fine.
The shaila really is in the other direction. What happens if they already gave maaser on the money and now you get it? Do you have to pay maaser again? That we'll get to in a few minutes. Okay.
If there's a loss over here.
We're not talking about a practical example here, are we? I'm sure not, right?
If there's a loss over here and you. Can you carry over the loss over the next year?
Can you carry over the loss to the next year? Meaning what? Tell me exactly what you're asking in terms of maaser.
I did a lot of business. The bottom line is I lost 10,000.
Good. So what do you want to know now?
Next year I'm going to make 50,000.
Good.
Do I have to pay 5,000 or can I...
No, so you could look at every year separately. That's what most of the posts can say. Can you put them together?
Because it's minus 10 and plus 50. So over 2 years I made 40.
Right. So
but if I split the years, then the 50, I'd have to pay 5. If I put the 2 years together, I only have to pay 4.
I understand. So I think it's usually assumed that you should do each year separately and that you should not try to do what you're doing. that does not seem to be recommended by most of the things that I've seen. It seems to be that each year should be calculated separately. And for the whole year, you're allowed to do that. That's what we said before. If you have part of the year you make a lot of money and part of the year you don't, so then you absolutely can do that. But from year to year, it generally is assumed that you should not do that. If it's for whatever reason, a shas at the chak, it could be, maybe there's what to talk about. But usually that's not usually done.
Yaakov Avinu waited over 20 years.
I don't know what he did. I don't know when he gave his money. He doesn't say. Okay, so we'll have to talk about this later. All right, we'll talk about this later.
In his dream that the Malach told him, said it's time to pay you the...
Yeah, but which how many years before that is he saying that he didn't pay for? And was he talking about Maser, or he's talking about other things? His
Maser, the son that he said is my lady as a result.
Right. Go and come back and I'll give you your Maser as well, on the flock which you made.
Right, so I have to look at the example Lashon and Rashi. Do you remember the example Lashon and Rashi? If you want to go look it up while they're during the shir, if you want to go get a chumash, feel free to... I don't know if it was clear when, how many years it was from, and if that's exactly the Maser. Actually, no, you're right, actually. That is the Maser that he was talking about there. Okay, so that's a good question. It could be that Yaakov was different because Yaakov was in Chutz Laaretz, so maybe he couldn't do exactly what he had thought he was going to do because he needed to make his matzeva in Eretz Yisrael, whatever it was. There might be other factors that would exempt Yaakov in that situation. But good point. Okay, let's go on here. Who is Chayv and Maser Ksofim? This goes back to your question now. Again, we don't have time to go into this in detail, which I think here maybe we should. But for now, we'll leave it as the basics. And if next week, if you want to revisit this topic, I'm happy to do so. For now... we mentioned last year, we'll mention it again. So the Aruch HaShulchan says the following. I think it's not on the source sheet, unfortunately. Yeah, I apologize. I think it did not get on the source sheet. No. It was on last year's source sheet, and somehow it did not get on this one. But basically, the Aruch HaShulchan says that how do you decide if you're chayv and maser? So the answer is if you do not have enough money to survive with on a very, very minimal level, then the halacha is that you are patur for maser. So in a case where you end up the year with a loss, so again, obviously you survive, but the point is with the money that you made during this year, if you lost money during the year, then you're absolutely not chayav in the midst of maaser. There still is a midst of tzedakah, which means that you still have to deal with what we discussed last week, your shlishis ha-shekel, your one-third of a shekel that you have to pay. And it could be that when aniyim come to you, it could be that you have to give them a little something. That's again a question that depends on a lot of the other factors we discussed. But in terms of maaser, your one-tenth, you absolutely are putter in that situation. The Aruch HaShulchan's definition is what he calls lechem tsaru mayim. If you just have a little bit of bread and water, then you're patur from maaser. But if you have anything more than that, that's considered to be already living with a little bit of luxury, and then perhaps you would be chayav in maaser. Today, it seems to be that the consensus of poskim today in general, is that it follows the society that you live in. So if in your society, you do not live in comfortably like everybody else does, whatever that means, and wherever you live, then you probably would putter from Maser. And that can be determined based on things that, you know, people around you are, you do normally, and you sometimes have to skip out on things which are, you know, basic necessities or basic things that you probably would want to have, but you don't have enough money for them. So you'll skip out, and maybe buying that extra coat that you need or going out to eat once in a while that you normally would do, but you can't do because you don't have enough money, even if that's normally accepted in that society to do those things. So generally speaking, that's considered to be enough to exempt you from Maser Ksafim if you are not at the level of what's considered to be normal in that society. Again, we're not talking about, you know, the richest society, but at least whatever the average mean of that society is, or maybe even the lower standard of that society. If you're not quite at, you know, the level that generally people would consider to be comfortable, then you probably are putter from Maser. And Rav Moshe, one of his tshuvas that we'll see either tonight or next time, basically spells that out. He says, you're asking me all these questions about how much money to give for this and how much the taxes are, etc., etc., but the amount of money that you're telling me seems to me, says Rav Moshe, that you don't make enough money to be chayav and maser in the first place. So that's going to be an important point that we will come back to a number of times, probably more next week. But when we calculate, when I tell you as we go on that you have to include a lot of your expenses in your maser accounts, at the end of the day what's going to come out is that after all your expenses, if you don't make enough money to pay your 1/10 of maser and have anything left over to actually, you know, survive or to feed your family, then the halacha is that you probably are putter from maser. Okay? That's, again, something to keep in mind, which we will come back to in the future. Yeah. Okay, good question. So we will discuss that either tonight or next week, God willing. Okay, we'll deal with some more of the details, and hopefully things will become a little bit clearer. Okay, let's go to the next section. What money is chayav and maser? How much money that you get is chayav and maser, and from what sources does it come from that would cause you to be chayav? So the general rule that's assumed by basically all the poskim, is that any profit that you make from any source is, generally speaking, included in money that is chayav and maser. Okay, this includes money that you make, obviously, off a salary, money that you make from any type of investment, which we'll qualify in just a minute, but in general, money that you make from there, money that you get as gifts from other people, all these kinds of things are, generally speaking, included in money which is chayav in maser. That's what you have to look at. How much money did you make from basically any source over the year? Let's take some specific examples, and then if you have questions, we can talk about them. First point, realized profit versus actual profit. Let's say you invest money in the stock market, and your stocks go up. I don't know if that's happening anytime, if that's happened recently, but let's just say that your stocks actually go up. So in that type of situation, are you chayav to pay maser from the money, the amount of value that what you have went up or not? So the consensus of poskim, as we mentioned, and this is mentioned by all the poskim here that I've seen, Rabbi Taub, Rav Moshe, is quoted as saying this in one of the books. Rabbi Willig also holds it this way. Basically, everybody holds that only actual money that you get, that you have in your hand, or that's actually in your bank account, is chayav and maser. Anything which is not actual profit, you haven't actually seen, you have not taken it out yet of whatever investment funds it's in, or whatever it is, the halacha is, then in that case, then that's not treated as actual revach, it's not actual money, and you're not chayav and maser.
But it's realized gains.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Only actualized gains are included here, not potential profit. Anything which you made but has not actually been taken out yet is not included. When you take it out, then you would be chayav and maser, assuming that you actually made something off of it. Okay, next case. So this is another... Actually, we'll skip that one for now. Benefits. This is an interesting point. If you get benefits from your job, so are you chayav to pay maser from your benefit money? So the answer is that Rav Shlomo Zalman seems to hold, and I think this is accepted by most poskim. He's quoted in Rav Tal's book and other places, that for benefits you have to treat that as if you're getting a profit, and therefore you'll be chayav and maser in most situations. So to give an example, and then if you have questions you can ask. When it comes to, let's say, you get insurance from your company, or extra insurance over and beyond what you're getting, you're getting pension, whatever it is, any of these kinds of things, that is considered to be something extra, which has to be treated as the amount of money that you would have had to pay in order to get that, if you wanted to have gotten it, if you would have gotten it otherwise, then you have to treat that as extra here, and therefore you'd have to be chayav in maser.
Say again? That's not necessarily something you have in your hand.
You're right, but the point is that once they, you're correct, But once they give you something extra in addition to your salary, not when
they're matching the $100 I'm putting in when I'm 30, but when I'm 65 and I'm taking the pension out, that's when I have to get my.
That's definitely true. What we're saying here is that even now, anything that you would have done yourself, again, maybe pension is not the best example, but any example. Second, we'll get to that also in a minute. Okay, we'll come back to that.
This is like a carrier stumble. Like the employer puts in 2.5% and the employer matches 7.5%. So that 7.5% is basically you're getting it.
That's because you don't have access to it. You can't do anything with it.
Right.
Then you're all in 7 years or whatever, you'll be able to take it out, and then you say, master, for the time being, I want the money, and I can't get it. Why should I?
Okay, everything. So I'll check that just to make sure. My impression, they do talk about it here. Let's see what they say. My impression is that in that situation that you can, if you have no access to the money at this moment, then you don't have to worry about it in terms of Maser. That seems to be what they say. I'll have to look again, see if I can find it.
The same is for an insurance. The company decides they want to give me life insurance
right.
for whatever. I die live or has the shalom.
Right.
No.
Right.
In one case, I don't have any profit from the money. In another case, when the money is paid out to the beneficiaries,
right.
they give master. Why should I give anything now?
Okay, so the only question is like this. If you would have bought life insurance otherwise yourself, or if you would have paid for any of these things yourself, and now you don't have to because you're getting it from then we would say that they're chayav and maaser. If that's not the case, or if it's not something that you would have done on your own, then you're correct. I think you're correct. Again, I'll tell you if I end up being wrong, I'll let you know. But I think you're correct that in that type of situation, you would not be chayav and maaser because you don't have it right now. It's not something you can use at this moment. Is that, I think that's we'll just see here if he had any other points here that he pointed out. It says here. I'll just read you the way Rabbi Tau presents it here and tell me if you disagree. He says, any fringe benefits received due to one's job must be included in one's total salary before maaser is separated. Therefore, one who receives medical insurance or dental insurance through his employer, again, this is talking about America, where you usually would be paying for your insurance on your own, okay, maybe not the same thing in Eretz Yisrael, but you get the point, must count the value of the plan in his salary for the purpose of giving maaser. This only applies if one would have purchased such insurance anyway. However, if he would not have purchased it, he would not have to include the value in his salary. So essentially, whatever money you would have shelled out on your own instead that you're getting from your employer would have to be counted as maaser. Anything that you would not have paid for, or you wouldn't have paid as much money for, you would have paid less, but not as much as they're giving you, then you would not that money would not be chayav in maaser.
So just for argument's sake, you have a family plan and you're working for a group employer, and the premiums in total $10,000. You as the employee pay 25% of the premiums.
Right.
They pay
right.
the other 75. So $7,500. You have to add to your cheshbon, even though it doesn't go show up on your W-2 per
right,
se.
Correct.
But you have
correct.
To count that as part of your maaser.
Correct. Right? That's what the post can say. Again, assuming that you would have gotten the same kind of insurance plan on your own if you didn't get it from the company. If you would have gotten a cheaper plan, then maybe you would pay less.
If you would have gotten a more expensive plan.
Chances are, if you shop on your own, it may be more expensive.
Then I think then you don't have to worry about more expensive plans. Just worry about
what the company is giving.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Taxes affect maaser at all?
Yeah, we'll get. We'll give me a few minutes. Yeah.
They have it here, but in America, you have flex spending accounts where I have $1,000 that I put towards child care, but instead of doing it after I pay taxes, I do it before I pay. I don't have to pay taxes on it.
So
then it's really complicated. Now I got to figure out how much taxes I would have paid if I had paid $1,000 after taxes, not before taxes, and then take 10% on that. It's
good. Okay, so taxes, let's hold off on for now. Maybe we'll get to it briefly tonight, or maybe we'll save it for next week and we'll do it more in detail. Okay, a few other points here, just to add in here. When it comes to Yerusha, somebody asked before about Yerusha. So Yerusha, generally speaking, this is a long Pesachei Tshuva, which I originally had on the source sheet, but it was too long, so I took it out. The Pesachei Tshuva seems to say in Reish Mem Tes that Yerusha, at least according to the sheet that he quotes there, most opinions hold that Yerusha is Chayav and Maser. Again, Yerusha is considered to be like a profit. If you get an inheritance, then you're making that money, and therefore you would have to pay maaser on what you got. That's what the seems to be the consensus of poskim.
If you're keeping it within the family, let's say you're getting Yerusha from grandparents, let's say.
It shouldn't matter. I don't think it would matter.
No, the only reason why I'm asking is because your grandparents, theoretically, let's say your grandparents, let's say they had $10,000, and you know that they they religiously gave Maser all
the time. Okay, so this is the important point. So the important point here is this is what the Poskim seem to say, and this also Rabbi Tab mentions, I forgot who he quotes here, but it's logical. We don't look at the Maser money that they already paid on the Yerusha. What we look at is at the moment that you get it, you are now making a profit, regardless of where the money was beforehand, regardless of what happened to the money beforehand. Once you are making that profit right now, you have an individual personal obligation to separate, or not obligation, a personal custom of minhag, whatever it is, to separate separate maser. You would need to separate maser from this as well, regardless of what they did beforehand. That seems to be the understanding. And it makes sense, because we're saying maser is not a family plan. Maser is an individual or a couple-wise obligation on you specifically, not on your grandparents. And therefore, once you get it now, you'd have to pay maser.
But going back to the question before, if there's somebody who does their maser once a year,
yeah,
and they died during that year, and they were intending, they saved up until that point $50,000 a year. So, and now I receive their $50,000.
That's a good question. That's a good question. So we don't have time to get into now. That is a discussion in the postcom in that case, whether you're supposed to take
20%.
Right. Good question. So that's a little bit of a longer discussion. There is a bit of an arichas about that. It seems to be, I think in that case, that really we tried to give the money that was designated for tzedakah, even after he's not alive anymore. But again, if you want to discuss that more in detail, we can talk about it afterwards, or I'll bring it in again next week. John, do you have a question? Okay, good. So again, that's a separate issue, which really would have gone in the, which is in a different topic. It's not really, you know, your personal obligation for Maser. That's really a question of when somebody dies, what do you do with his money afterwards? Do you have to give Maser if you don't know if he gave it or if he knew that he designated it? That's a question, and that's really part of a separate topic, which we're not going to have time to get into now. We can maybe talk about that afterwards.
Clothes and things like that, do you have to give Maser on their value as well?
One more time, if you do what?
Anything intangible.
What are you saying? If you get clothes as a gift?
If you can have inheritance. Well,
same question. Okay, good. So give me a minute. We have 5 minutes left.
House.
Good question. Okay, so let's get there.
The house inheritance.
It's intangible.
How do you... Do you have to sell it in order to pay... give 10% of its value?
One more time? Again.
House.
Right. What's the question?
You inherit the house. It's worth $1 million.
Right.
So you should give $100,000. You don't have $100,000. Do you have to sell the house in order?
Good. So the answer is probably not. You don't know. Probably not. Let me get to the next category of gifts, and then probably the questions will be answered. And whatever we don't have time for tonight, we can spill over to next week. The story with gifts is as follows. Okay. Generally speaking, it's usually assumed, as we would expect, that if you get a monetary gift, you get a check from your relatives or from a friend for $3,000, whatever it is. That gift, that money is chayav and maser. That's the general assumption. Here are the details, perhaps the limitations. Let's say that the gift is given to you on condition that you don't give maser, meaning your parents give you money and say, here, take this $3,000 and use it to pay your bills, or use it to get something to build on another, for the kids, or to build on another part of your house, whatever it is. So in that case, if they tell you to do it for that specific reason, then, so the Sefer Tzedakah U'Mishpat, and I think Rabbi Taub quotes this as well from there, basically says that you probably should not give maser from that money. What's the reason why? Because the halakha is based on Choshen Mishpat, that if somebody gives you a gift on the condition, or with the implied or implicit condition that you are supposed to use that gift or that money for something specific, you shouldn't use it for other things. So if they give you a money and they tell you to use it for this, that, X, Y, and Z, so then you can assume that what they mean is for you to use it for that and not for you to be giving maser money from, and therefore you would not have to give maser money from that type of money. If they tell you to do with it whatever you want, they say use it for whatever's good, then already there's more to discuss. That case you probably do have to give maser from, because they haven't put a tag on it of what it's supposed to be going for. Does anybody have a question on that point? No? Okay. Next section, in terms of gifts. So if you get actual gifts, you get clothes, you get books, you get anything like that. So what's the story with that? So that is a machlokas haposkim. Some poskim say that you actually are chayav to give maser in that also in terms of the value. And many poskim say that that you're not obligated to give maser on that, because maser only comes from actual money. This is a top quote. It's also Rabbeinu Yonah seems to say that you do have to separate maser, and the Sefer Tzedakah U'Mishpat quotes others that say that you would not have to give maser because it's not actual money. The minhag seems to be like, take a guess which approach? Second? Not to give. Very good. That seems to be the minhag, and Rabbi Willig also seems to take that... Good, that's a good point. So they mention that. They point this out. There actually was a question about Yaakov, whether Yaakov was giving maser from all of his things or just from his money. That's a discussion. But when it comes to the minog of Maaser Kesafim, so again, it could be that the minog of Maaser Kesafim is not exactly parallel to Yaakov Avinu. That's basically what they would have to, the Mekilah would have to say here. Yaakov again decided what he wanted to do on his own, but our minog, we have developed a minog tov in Klal Yisrael that we have the custom of giving Maaser, but if the minog that we've accepted is not to give Maaser on, you know, gifts, then if that's really the minog ha'olam, that we don't do that, then since the whole thing is based on minog in the first place, it shouldn't be shouldn't necessarily be such a problem. That seems to be the
but if you live in a system where in general people do transactions through bartering, then really anything that you have which is barterable could be, you can take maaser from.
That's an interesting question.
If Yaakov Avinu has sheep and cattle and whatnot, he can take maaser from those things because those are barterable objects, which are worth, they have value to them, and therefore you can part of them. Whereas nowadays, if you have, I don't know, people use money nowadays. People don't, right. You know, depending where you live, I guess. Our cousins still, but we have to use probably only money.
I hear. Okay, it's an interesting point. I haven't thought of that. According to the people that say that you would only have give maaser on money, I don't know what they would say in those type of systems where they only did bartering. Maybe they would say, what would they say? Well, when let's say if you want to give, you know, poor people, if you wanted to give aniyim something, what would you give them? You would give them food?
You'd probably give them, yeah.
Good. Maybe you would say that the amounts, yeah, okay, I have to think about that. It's a good point. Maybe you say that the amount that you would have to give them food rather than money, but you give them food proportionate to 10% of the food that you crops that you grow during the year, which essentially, I'll tell you the truth, that's not really maaser kesafim anymore. That's already maaser, the real maaser. That's maaser, you know, trumos and maaser. So that's really the way that the din d'oraisa to begin with, that this whole thing might be based on, is really that. So you're really going back to, you know, it's not maaser kesafim anymore. It's really more what did you grow that year. But if you're talking about a system where you're not actually growing the crops, you're, you know, doing things and you get exchange for that, you get food in exchange, then I already have a question. In that case, you didn't grow it, but you get the food in exchange for other things that you give. Then you have a good question, which I guess I won't give you an answer right now. Okay, I'll just tell you the points that we didn't get to very quickly right now. We didn't mention the question of inflation. Most poskim seem to hold that inflation does not necessarily count as profit if you know that that's what happens. That's what most poskim hold. Though there are poskim that hold that if you have a house that went up in value, and then you sell that house and get extra money, that already might be chayv and maaser. If we want to discuss that more, we can come back to that next week if you want. If that's
just on what you said in terms of inflation, if there's inflation, usually you hold the money, the money is worth less.
Right. Well, it could go in either direction. Let's say we call it deflation. We want to call it deflation. Okay, fine. So deflation, whatever it is, deflation.
Let's say you talk about inflation of your assets. Let's say the house has gone up in value.
That's an unrealized.
Right.
You have a fund.
Right.
You have an inflation-linked fund.
Yeah, I'll read you the Rebbe Taub here. And again, this is based on a tshuva from Rav Moshe, which I don't have on the source sheet. And if you want to talk about this more, we can talk about this more next week. I'll just read you the summary that he gives here, and read it at that. Basically, he says, one who sold his house and received more money than he originally paid for it is required to separate maaser from the profit. However, this requirement only applies if the increase in value is the result of an increased demand for his home or because the location is highly desirable. On the other hand, if a portion of the increase was due to inflation of the real estate market or the devaluation of the local currency, he need not separate maaser from that portion of his profit. That's what Rav Moshe seems to say in one of his tshuvas. Rav Shlomo Zalman seems to agree with that as well. And they give an example, but they say basically that you have to... Rav Moshe says you have to know that the increase in value is due to inflation and not due to other factors. If you think that it might be due to other factors, then you probably still have to give maaser.
People should know.
Okay, so maybe we'll come. Maybe we'll come back to that next week. Maybe I'll put for you all next week's source sheet. I'll put the truth from Rav Moshe on, and we can do it inside maybe. But that, I think for now we'll leave it at that. So on the schedule for next week, so we didn't get to yet for this week. We'll get to next week. So we'll maybe just take a couple of minutes to talk about the inflation and houses going up in value. Then we have to get into all the questions of deductions for maaser. Which things can you deduct from? That gets into business expenses. All the tax issues come from there. And then questions about household expenses. Can you deduct household expenses as well? That we'll deal with hopefully next week. And that will be the maaser worksheet that I gave you on the source sheet. Make sure if you either want to give it back to me or bring it back next week, because we're going to need that. That's very important. We'll go through that worksheet. And then the last part will be the question of what can you use your master money for? Which types of purposes can you be giving your master money to in terms of, again, organizations or in terms of, you know, giving your kids money if they need money to support themselves? All those kinds of things we'll also hopefully get to either next week or the week afterwards.